Chapter 18. His black hair's gray, his gray hair's white. Cut down every stick of timber, and heaven knows what all, had he not, like a skillful gardener, minded his crafting, and changed the sort, till at length this right-minded man fell down on his knees every night and morning, and thanked God, that he was not as other meanly descended fathers in such matters. It was in the peculiar disposition of the Petrick family that the satisfaction which ultimately settled in Timothy's breast found nourishment. The Petricks had adored the nobility, and plucked them at the same time. That excellent man Isaac Walton's feelings about fish were much akin to those of old Timothy Petrick, and of his descendants in a lesser degree, concerning the landed aristocracy. To torture and to love simultaneously is a proceeding strange to reason, but possible to practice, as these instances show. Hence, when Timothy's brother Edward said slightingly one day that Timothy's son was well enough, but that he had nothing but shops and offices in his backward perspective, while his own children, should he have any, would be far different in possessing such a mother as the Honorable Harriet, Timothy felt a bound of triumph within him at the power he possessed of contradicting that statement if he chose. So much was he interested in his boy in this new aspect, that he now began to read up chronicles of the illustrious house ennobled as the Dukes of Southwesterland, from their very beginning in the glories of the restoration of the blessed Charles till the year of his own time. He mentally noted their gifts from royalty, grants of lands, purchases, intermarriages, plantings and buildings, more particularly their political and military achievements, which had been great, and their performances in art and letters, which had been by no means contemptible. He studied prints of the portraits of that family, and then, like a chemist watching a crystallization, began to examine young Rupert's face for the unfolding of those historic curves and shades that the painters Van Dyck and Lely had perpetuated on canvas. When the boy reached the most fascinating age of childhood, and his shouts of laughter ran through Stapleford House from end to end, the remorse that oppressed Timothy Petrick knew no bounds. Of all people in the world, this Rupert was the one on whom he could have wished the estates to devolve. Yet Rupert, by Timothy's own desperate strategy at the time of his birth, had been ousted from all inheritance of them. And, since he did not mean to remarry, the manors would pass to his brother and his brother's children, who would be nothing to him, whose boasted pedigree on one side would be nothing to his Rupert's. Had he only left the first will of his grandfather alone? His mind ran on the wills continually, both of which were in existence, and the first, the cancelled one, in his own possession. Night after night, when the servants were all abed, and the click of safety locks sounded as loud as a crash, he looked at that first will, and wished it had been the second, and not the first. The crisis came at last. One night, after having enjoyed the boy's company for hours, he could no longer bear that his beloved Rupert should be dispossessed, and he committed the felonious deed of altering the date of the earlier will to a fortnight later, which made its execution appear subsequent to the date of the second will already proved. He then boldly propounded the first will as the second. His brother Edward submitted to what appeared to be not only incontestable fact, but a far more likely disposition of old Timothy's property, for, like many others, he had been much surprised at the limitations defined in the other will, having no clue to their cause. He joined his brother Timothy in setting aside the hitherto accepted document, and matters went on in their usual course, there being no dispositions in the substituted will differing from those in the other, except such as related to a future which had not yet arrived. The years moved on. Rupert had not yet revealed the anxiously expected historic lineaments which should foreshadow the political abilities of the Dussel family aforesaid, when it happened on a certain day that Timothy Petrick made the acquaintance of a well-known physician of Budmouth, who had been the medical adviser and friend of the late Mrs. Petrick's family for many years, though after Annetta's marriage, and consequent removal to Stapleford, He had seen no more of her, the neighboring practitioner who attended the Petricks having then become her doctor as a matter of course. Timothy was impressed by the insight and knowledge disclosed in the conversation of the Budmouth physician, and the acquaintance ripening to intimacy, the physician alluded to a form of hallucination to which Annetta's mother and grandmother had been subject, that of believing in certain dreams as realities. He delicately inquired if Timothy had ever noticed anything of the sort in his wife during her lifetime. He, the physician, had fancied that he discerned germs of the same peculiarity in Annetta when he attended her in her girlhood. One explanation begat another, till the dumbfoundered Timothy Petrick was persuaded in his own mind that Annetta's confession to him had been based on a delusion. "You look down in the mouth?" said the doctor, pausing. A bit unmanned. "'Tis unexpected like," sighed Timothy. But he could hardly believe it possible, and, thinking it best to be frank with the doctor, told him the whole story which, till now, he had never related to living man, save his dying grandfather. To his surprise, the physician informed him that such a form of delusion was precisely what he would have expected from Annetta's antecedents at such a physical crisis in her life. Petrick prosecuted his inquiries elsewhere, and the upshot of his labors was, briefly, that a comparison of dates and places showed irrefutably that his poor wife's assertion could not possibly have foundation in fact. The young Marquis of her tender passion, a highly moral and bright-minded nobleman, had gone abroad the year before Annetta's marriage, and had not returned till after her death. The young girl's love for him had been a delicate ideal dream no more. Timothy went home, and the boy ran out to meet him, whereupon a strangely dismal feeling of discontent took possession of his soul. After all, then, there was nothing but plebeian blood in the veins of the heir to his name and estates. He was not to be succeeded by a noble-natured line. To be sure, Rupert was his son, but that glory and halo he believed him to have inherited from the ages, outshining that of his brother's children, had departed from Rupert's brow forever. He could no longer read history in the boy's face, and centuries of domination in his eyes. His manner towards his son grew colder and colder from that day forward, and it was with bitterness of heart that he discerned the characteristic features of the Petricks unfolding themselves by degrees. Instead of the elegant knife-edged nose, so typical of the Dukes of Southwesterland, there began to appear on his face the broad nostril and hollow bridge of his grandfather Timothy. No illustrious line of politicians was promised a continuator in that graying blue eye, for it was acquiring the expression of the orb of a particularly objectionable cousin of his own. And, instead of the mouth curves which had thrilled parliamentary audiences in speeches now bound in calf in every well-ordered library, there was the bull lip of that very uncle of his who had had the misfortune with the signature of a gentleman's will, and had been transported for life in consequence. To think how he himself, too, had sinned in this same matter of a will for this mere fleshly reproduction of a wretched old uncle whose very name he wished to forget. The boy's Christian name, even, was an imposture and an irony, for it implied hereditary force and brilliance to which he plainly would never attain. The consolation of real sonship was always left him certainly, but he could not help groaning to himself, "Why cannot a son be one's own, and somebody else's likewise?" The Marquis was shortly afterwards in the neighborhood of Stapleford, and Timothy Petrick met him, and eyed his noble countenance admiringly. The next day, when Petrick was in his study, somebody knocked at the door. "Who's there?" Rupert. "I'll Rupert thee, you young impostor. Say, only a poor commonplace Petrick." His father grunted. "Why didn't you have a voice like the Marquis I saw yesterday?" He continued, as the lad came in. "Why haven't you his looks, and a way of commanding, as if you'd done it for centuries, hey?" Why? How can you expect it, father, when I'm not related to him? Apostrophe, ugh. Then you ought to be. Apostrophe growled his father. As the narrator paused, the surgeon, the colonel, the historian, the spark, and others exclaimed that such subtle and instructive psychological studies as this, now that psychology was so much in demand, were precisely the tales they desired, as members of a scientific club, and begged the master maltster to tell another curious mental delusion. The maltster shook his head, and feared he was not genteel enough to tell another story with a sufficiently moral tone in it to suit the club. He would prefer to leave the next to a better man. The colonel had fallen into reflection. True it was, he observed, that the more dreamy and impulsive nature of woman engendered within her erratic fancies, which often started her on strange tracks, only to abandon them in sharp revulsion at the dictates of her common sense sometimes with ludicrous effect. Events which had caused the lady's action to set in a particular direction might continue to enforce the same line of conduct, while she, like a mangle, would start on a sudden in a contrary course, and end where she began. The vice president laughed and applauded the colonel, adding that there surely lurked a story somewhere behind that sentiment, if he were not much mistaken. The colonel fixed his face to a good narrative pose, and went on without further preamble. Dame the Seventh. Anna, Lady Baxby by the colonel, it was in the time of the great civil war, if I should not rather, as a loyal subject, call it, with Clarendon, the great rebellion. It was, I say, at that unhappy period of our history, that towards the autumn of a particular year, the Parliament forces sat down before Sherton Castle with over 7,000 foot and 4 pieces of cannon. The castle, as we all know, was in that century owned and occupied by one of the Earls of Severn, and garrisoned for his assistance by a certain noble marquis who commanded the king's troops in these parts. The said Earl, as well as the young Lord Baxby, his eldest son, were away from home just now, raising forces for the king elsewhere. But there were present in the castle, when the besiegers arrived before it, the son's fair wife Lady Baxby, and her servants, together with some friends, and near relatives of her husband, and the defense was so good, and well considered, that they anticipated no great danger. The parliamentary forces were also commanded by a noble lord, for the nobility were by no means, at this stage of the war, all on the king's side, and it had been observed during his approach in the night time, and in the morning when the reconnoitering took place, that he appeared sad and much depressed. The truth was that, by a strange freak of destiny, it had come to pass that the stronghold he was set to reduce was the home of his own sister, whom he had tenderly loved during her maidenhood, and whom he loved now, in spite of the estrangement which had resulted from hostilities with her husband's family. He believed, too, that, notwithstanding this cruel division, she still was sincerely attached to him. His hesitation to point his ordnance at the walls was inexplicable to those who were strangers to his family history. He remained in the field on the north side of the castle, called by his name to this day, because of his encampment there, till it occurred to him to send a messenger to his sister Anna with a letter, in which he earnestly requested her, as she valued her life, to steal out of the place by the little gate to the south, and make away in that direction to the residence of some friends. Shortly after he saw, to his great surprise, coming from the front of the castle walls a lady on horseback, with a single attendant. She rode straight forward into the field, and up the slope to where his army and tents were spread. It was not till she got quite near that he discerned her to be his sister Anna, and much was he alarmed that she should have run such risk as to sally out in the face of his forces without knowledge of their proceedings, when at any moment their first discharge might have burst forth to her own destruction in such exposure. She dismounted before she was quite close to him, and he saw that her familiar face, though pale, was not at all tearful, as it would have been in their younger days. Indeed, if the particulars as handed down are to be believed, He was in a more tearful state than she, in his anxiety about her. He called her into his tent, out of the gaze of those around. For though many of the soldiers were honest and serious-minded men, he could not bear that she who had been his dear companion in childhood should be exposed to curious observation in this her great grief. When they were alone in the tent, he clasped her in his arms, for he had not seen her since those happier days when, at the commencement of the war, her husband and himself had been of the same mind about the arbitrary conduct of the king, and had little dreamt that they would not go to extremes together. She was the calmest of the two, it is said, and was the first to speak connectedly. "William, I have come to you," apostrophe said she, "but not to save myself as you suppose. Why, oh, why do you persist in supporting this disloyal cause, and grieving us so?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe, say not that, apostrophe," he replied hastily. "If truth hides at the bottom of a well, why should you suppose justice to be in high places? I am for the right at any price. Anna, leave the castle, you are my sister. Come away, my dear, and save thy life." "Apostrophe, apostrophe, never." "Apostrophe, apostrophe," says she. "Do you plan to carry out this attack, and level the castle indeed?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe, most certainly I do," apostrophe says he. "What meaneth this army around us if not so?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe, then you will find the bones of your sister buried in the ruins you cause." "Apostrophe, apostrophe," said she. And without another word she turned and left him. "Anna, abide with me." "Apostrophe, apostrophe," he entreated. "Blood is thicker than water, and what is there in common between you and your husband now?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe," but she shook her head, and would not hear him, and hastening out, mounted her horse, and returned towards the castle as he had come. "Eh, many's the time when I have been riding to hounds across that field, that I have thought of that scene." When he had quite gone down the field, and over the intervening ground, and round the bastion, so that he could no longer even see the tip of her mare's white tail, he was much more deeply moved by emotions concerning her, and her welfare than he had been while she was before him. He wildly reproached himself that he had not detained her by force for her own good, so that, come what might, she would be under his protection, and not under that of her husband, whose impulsive nature rendered him too open to instantaneous impressions and sudden changes of plan. He was now acting in this Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.